you don't get it. This isn't about Earth. Come midnight, Christmas Day, Santa Claus is coming to town, and unless we stop him, he is going to put the universe on the naughty list. And trust me, you don't want to be on the naughty list.
Sorry I asked.
So Santa's evil?
No. Zinyak's had Santa trapped for decades, slowly but surely degrading his mind. If we don't free him soon, it'll be too late, and he'll never be jolly old Saint Nick again.
Guys, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. All right, I'll save Santa.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special holiday episode of the Foodie Dashi podcast. Lauren just left. She'll be back.
I'm still here.
So I am, of course, here with the wonderful, the fantastic, our resident game developer, Lauren. I am your resident moron slash academic, Nicholas. And so today we're gonna do a nice cheery episode, aren't we, Lauren? We're going to talk about Christmassy things.
We are going to talk about Christmassy things and games that can be classified as Christmas games.
Yeah, so before we started recording, Lauren was talking about playing... okay, actually, Lauren, you introduce it. You did a much better job than I will.
Yeah, I've been playing Cyberpunk, but I've actually been playing Yakuza Kiwami, which I'm walking through the world and I'm trying to figure out why is this so immersive. It's a remastered experience, like a remastered title. It's an older title, so you can see that the textures don't have a lot of depth, if that makes any sense. And it doesn't feel realistic, and yet everything's perfect. It's super immersive. The world just feels like it's really topical. Like I'm walking outside right now. And then I go into a konbini or a convenience store and it's playing like, "All I Want for Christmas Is You." And like, all of the Christmas songs.
And that's not accurate at all. No, that's very
accurate. That's not accurate at all.
No, because...
it feels like super Christmassy. And suddenly I'm just like... Or it's like Silent Night, Jingle Bells. Like it's all this Christmas music is happening in convenience stores. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a Christmas game. This is exactly like I'm outside in my real world, yeah. Right? Listening, and you'd be hearing those Christmas songs that I'd have to put it in my apartment now.
Well, it's not a very like Japanese Christmassy song, because Japanese Christmassy songs are like Last Christmas, like Wham's Last Christmas, like Last Christmas.
Honestly, it might be Last. I love Last Christmas by Wham. Yeah, Last Christmas, I gave
like,
you my heart.
Strangely, but like fried chicken is a Christmas thing in Japan. Like specifically,
yes.
KFC fried chicken is a Christmas thing in Japan. And if you go to Japan, the first thing you should do is you should have your picture taken with one of the incredibly surreal Colonel Sanders statues that are outside nearly every single Kentucky Fried Chicken there.
Yes.
Second thing you should do is you should actually eat the chicken, because it's actually better than in the U.S.
it's pretty good.
Much better.
You
got your Christmas cake. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, speaking of KFC and things that are better in Japan, I really loved being in Shibuya. And like on the 20th floor, it was like this high-end expensive like restaurant area. Like the higher you get, the more expensive the restaurant is.
Yeah, it's usually the case. Yeah.
Right? That's usually the case. And if you go underground or like in the alleyways, then they're not that expensive. But that doesn't mean they're not good. And then here we are on like floor 20, and there's like this wait list for this really expensive brunch spot named Denny's.
Okay, Denny's is also totally different and also better.
It's totally different in Japan. And I'm like, what is going on? And I look at the menu and I'm like, this doesn't look different, right? Because it's half in English, right? Because it is a Denny's and it's half in Japanese. But man, like that was expensive pancake.
Yeah, and the foods are completely different too. Like,
yes.
If you go into a Japanese Denny's expecting to be able to get eggs, well, you won't, because they don't really serve.
No, they don't have eggs.
You can get like a single fried egg. But that's it. Like you can't get your standard like Denny's like starch and starch and starch and starch and eggs. Like that just, it doesn't, which is fine. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, which is interesting because like living in California, like, you know what a chive pancake is or like a shrimp pancake. Like you kind of have this like understanding of it in your brain, but then like you'll go to like the Denny's in Japan and pancake actually means like pancakey, like a thick pancake. And yet there they'll see pictures of like shrimp pancake, but it's like an American pancake, but also shrimp, but it's not like a shrimp chive pancake like you get in, like from, you know, like a Chinese place or even like a fusion kind of restaurant over here. So it like really, like the pancake level really blew my mind with how much I guess that word can represent.
I mean,
a bit of a tangent on food, but no, totally worth it for Christmas.
I appreciate this tangent because like it's interesting how there are all of these like especially like Western foods that in Japan often becomes like symbolic of completely inexplicable things. For example, the Christmas cake. Literally, the word in Japanese is kurisumasu keiki, which is a transliteration of Christmas cake. And it's literally a type of, it's actually a very bad cake, and it's got strawberries on it, which I don't like. I hate strawberries. It's a disgusting dry cake, but it's sort of a Christmas staple. But that's not what, but if you say the phrase kurisumasu keiki, or even sometimes just keiki, and use it to refer to a woman, it actually has a very specific meaning. It basically means like a woman who's too old to get married.
What? She's a Christmas cake?
So yeah. No, there's it's an extremely sexist, insulting thing to say to a woman is to refer to her as Christmas cake. The reason being because you buy it on the 25th and the next day it's already bad. So if a woman is older than 25, say 26, 27, it's like she is, quote, already bad. She's already gone off, so to speak.
I'm gone off. I'm over.
No, you're fine. Like I said, this is an extremely sexist thing. Like, I'm not trying to assert that this is true. Let me be very clear about that. But there are things like that.
That's why I make it. Like, I'm not gone.
I mean, and then there are the like, you know, the ones that are also grosser, like that I don't want to get into. Like, I'm not gonna tell you what maguro means. Maguro, which is the Japanese word for a particular type of tuna, I'm 100% not going to tell anyone what that means. You can look it up on your own, you skeevy bastards. But there's a lot.
Never use it, you skeevy bastards.
Yeah, that's true. I shouldn't
keep it to yourself.
I'm gonna edit that out.
You should edit that out.
Yeah, so it's Christmas time, and Christmas is actually a really important time for games. I mean, a lot of developers often want to get their games out by Christmas. We saw like two major games be delayed and then basically maybe not rushed, but definitely gotten out in time for Christmas. And the first example is World of Warcraft, the new World of Warcraft expansion Shadowlands, and then also the new Cyberpunk game, Cyberpunk 2077, which Lauren, you have been playing and I refuse to play. So why don't you talk about your experience?
Yeah, we could actually also talk about Shadowlands because I have also played I've played a little bit of Shadowlands. It's more apt to say I have played the new World of Warcraft character creator and starting zone.
That's a kind of gameplay that's important too.
Yeah, it is a kind of gameplay. I've also played the Cyberpunk 2077 character creator and starting zone three times because of the PS. I bought it for PS4.
Okay.
So for Christmas games, I mentioned Yakuza because I was playing Cyberpunk 2077, and its goal is to immerse you in this kind of RPG experience that is super open, and it makes you feel like it's a part of the world. And for me, I felt like, at least in all three of the games that I guess that I'm playing right now, I'm not really playing all three games at once, that would be crazy. Yakuza really made me feel a part of the world because of all the Christmassy music and like the Christmas decorations, and it just happens to be Christmas right now while I'm playing it.
Yeah.
Right. Versus like Cyberpunk and World of Warcraft to an extent. World of Warcraft has like Christmas, like
they have holiday elements. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. They have holiday elements, but I'm not really playing the holiday content because I'm just not, I don't really have a guild or people to play with. And Cyberpunk, on the other hand, also is like a very Christmas launch, right? Being launched December 10th, but also coming after the Game Awards. It was actually launched on the same day as the Game Awards.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Right? 2077 was not eligible or may not be eligible for any, right? They might be eligible for 2021, but basically when you're launching around this time, you're not really looking at getting any, say, game of the year or game awards things. You don't think you're going to be eligible for that versus something like Ghost of Tsushima. It gets, it's launched right in September, I guess, or not.
No, it was early. It was a summer release.
It was a summer release. So it's, it's launched in summer, has plenty of time, not only for people to review it, but also for DLC content to booster its chances, right, of getting something like a game of the year. Same with Last of Us 2, which we don't have to go into at all. For getting something like game of the year title. But when we've talked about like crunch and we've talked about these Christmas releases and being delayed, for me, like playing Cyberpunk 2077 is kind of like playing a game where you can see that COVID really, really hit the team.
Yeah.
And you can see that things that would have been really easy to do, say during crunch or overtime procedures, say in a studio, were made even harder because you weren't able, you had to social distance. You weren't able to go in person, right? It really slowed decision-making. And then also, yes, it delayed the title because of COVID, but it probably delayed the title. I don't think they were delayed because of bugs. I think they were delayed because of COVID. And then when they were delayed again, it was because they absolutely like just missed things like on certification or just missed things to be able to even get to be able to meet their ship, that ship date of December 10th because of COVID. Like, I do not think that it was the game. I think the game would have been in a much better state had COVID not happened, simply because it's just faster to fix those things.
Well, I've already been on the record that I think a lot of the, certainly when the most recent delay was announced, that a lot of the negative reactions online were absolutely childish. I've already said that.
It was absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm still kind of that opinion because it's like, basically, people are complaining that like there are bugs on one platform, literally one of many platforms. And I'm kind of like, yeah, that happens to lots of games.
So it's definitely the expectation. Like, so if we compare it to like Shadowlands that you brought up, that was also delayed and then came out during like Thanksgiving, that's a really strong window to release in.
Yeah.
Just because like it says, it's kind of right before the end of the fiscal year, but it's not so late that it looks like it was right before the fiscal year. Shadowlands, at least from my experience, didn't have a lot of bugs. It really felt a lot of like polish and a lot of love from the Blizzard developers.
Yeah.
And I know that Blizzard's come up kind of negatively in the news, but I mean, every company has at some point. But Shadowlands, Shadowlands felt like a good experience. But I would say that like, oh yeah, like Baldur's Gate came out as well. But so Shadowlands felt like a good experience, but you know, surprisingly, I was expecting more of a change. I get that they did level squishing and get that they did some other things. I haven't played the new content, which is 50 to 60.
Yeah.
I will admit that I just haven't played that new expansion. But leading up into the expansion, I was expecting something way more modern. Like if they're going to be doing this linear content, I expected more cinematic presentation. I expected less reliance on the older WoW systems, like accepting quests and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, when I'm playing Cyberpunk 2077, they get so much right in systems. I am going to say that right now.
Yeah.
They do so much right and so much well that I also find myself realizing that I think the problem happens that when gamers are playing these games, if a system is so good, you will never realize that it's there. And so a lot of the complaints Cyberpunk is getting from replayability, or not from replayability, but from base gameplay or from quests, is that they do everything so well, it's hidden from you. So you don't even recognize and realize that a system is there, such as saying dialogue choice, for example. If you never engage with, say, body as a stat, you will never see that stat ever appear in dialogue. You might see it if you're barely below it, right? But you just don't see it. If you engage really highly in one stat, you'll see that stat come up almost all of the time, right? So you're thinking, I don't have any choice, but actually in fact, you made that player decision to invest in a gameplay mechanic that directly impacts the narrative that you are being fed. And this happens everywhere. And so if you have six stats, that means there's six different outcomes. Not to say that if you say failed those six stats, there's probably two or three additional options or narrative choices you could make, which means there's like 9 total choices for just about every single like pivotal conversation.
Yeah.
Like that's absolutely absurd. So I bring that up to say Cyberpunk is doing just such incredible systems work here. That's just one aspect, okay?
Yeah.
Of their engineering team. And they probably honed all the bugs on that, and they honed the bugs on everything else. But Cyberpunk hasn't done an open world multiple character creator, right? They haven't done driving mechanics. They haven't done, right, a lot of things that people would expect of that genre. Yeah. And they also were trying, since they haven't done it, they really wanted to set that industry standard. So they had those internal high expectations for themselves. But also, gamers are now expecting so much innovation that I'm playing Cyberpunk. And as a developer, I am loving it.
Yeah.
But as a gamer, I am a gamer in scare quotes here. I'm seeing that it feels like it took decisions made those 8 years ago, because it's been in development for 8 years.
Yeah.
And so when you look at something like Shadowlands, when you look at these games that are coming out, especially around the Christmas season, it no longer feels like an experience that is so forward, say forward thinking, right? The longer development cycle gets, the older the game is going to feel, because those decisions that were set in stone so they could achieve, honestly, the impossible. Every game is a miracle when it's launched. Bugs or no bugs.
Yeah.
If there's no bugs, you just haven't found them yet. That's really the only, that's the only thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's happening here, is we're getting and we're playing Cyberpunk 2077, and we're expecting a game of 2020, which is also weird because they reference the year 2020 in this game almost all the time. And that's
bizarre. Well, I can actually explain why that is.
Let's tangent on that.
So Cyberpunk 2077 is actually based on an old pen and paper role-playing game called Cyberpunk. Imagine that. There are two major editions, or sort of two editions that people typically refer to when referring to the game. They either refer to the fourth edition, which was literally just called fourth edition, but the second edition of the game, which is often considered to be sort of like the best version, or like it was certainly the most fleshed out in terms of like secondary materials that were published for it, was Cyberpunk 2020, literally the year in which we are currently.
That's what it was called.
Just for my own edification, a couple of days ago, I actually picked up a copy of the old rule book and I scanned it for myself. I can do that. I own it. So just in case anyone's like, oh, he violated copyright. No, I did not violate copyright.
Only you, the academic, would be like, no, wait a second. I have to be very clear about this
because, yeah, in my profession, like, you have to be very clear about, like, you know, fair use and all those things. Like, no, this is a fair use. Like, I didn't. It's perfectly fine.
Sure. Yeah.
But what's interesting about it, the reason why I picked up a copy of it is because I specifically wanted to look at the character classes in Cyberpunk, because the character classes are bonkers. Like, it's very 80s. Very 80s.
Yes.
So Cyberpunk 2020, the second edition rulebook, came out in 1990. So even though it came out technically in the 90s, it reflects in like 80s mindset, like sort of the culmination of an 80s mindset. And so one of my favorite classes in the game, which is essentially a bard, like they very clearly took the like archetype of the bard from Dungeons and Dragons and then essentially reskinned it. But the character class is called Rocker Boy. And it's literally all about how, like, essentially you as a bard / rock star can like take the man down through the power of music. And yes, I'm like,
and
wow.
that's a character in the game basically called Johnny Silverhand.
Yep.
And I think that's where people, so like where I wanted to steer this for like, and sort of like a Christmassy thing is like, yeah, talking about the industry, how we get around Christmas time with like Game Awards and stuff.
Yeah.
But also I wanted to kind of steer it. We could talk more about Yakuza, but sorry, I was just excited about that. but I really wanted to steer it to look at like Cyberpunk and kind of at least like give a little bit of insight into like how much time, effort, and like incredible manpower was to truly revolutionize creating a tabletop RPG with like classes and like traditional D&D model of combat and style, and like how much engineering work I'm going to be very specific there because it was design as well.
Yeah.
But like how much engineering and say game direction went in to completely changing the rules of Cyberpunk 2020 and Cyberpunk the board game, because this game does not have classes. This game does not have rules. This game has a character creator, but it is so incredibly modern, I should say, is a title where you have stats and those stats affect what you're able to do.
Well, it's more seamless in the way that, say, like BioWare games are.
Yeah, it's super seamless. But because it's so seamless, it feels too good. It feels too seamless because gamers are used to being able to see the system. They're going, I get this. I'm a tank. I'm a healer. I do damage, right?
Yeah.
Players are really easy to get into that role. I do intimidation because I have strong strength, right? I have high charisma, so I can persuade people.
Yeah.
And a lot of games, even Greedfall, I was playing Greedfall earlier this year, which is great, literally just took every single like trope of good games, every single trope of RPGs, and like dialed it all up to like 11, which meant there were definitely bugs at 11. Yeah. But all of that was amazing. It was an incredible experience. I had a really small, tight team that basically said, we want to make like the pirate Victorian era, like Dragon Age, but with our own rule set and et cetera. And then they had two endings, and the second ending was just like totally throwaway. There's no reason why you'd do it. Yeah. But you could tell they ran out of development time for even making that second ending, right? Like emotionally worthy. But they made the first ending amazing. Like, yeah. Which honestly, they made an ending to their video game. Like, I'm great.
Yeah.
But contrast it to Cyberpunk, which like I'm still formulating opinions about because I am enjoying it. It's so immersive. It so gets you invested in the world right away that it hits that uncanny valley very quickly.
Okay.
And that's the problem. Because especially as someone who has studied and has a lot of like Japanese and East Asian friends and has just, I just am very much in that culture. There are things that I see that at first glance, if at first glance, they're not racist. That's what I'll say. And then at second glance, they are super freaking racist. And then at third glance, when you start to talk to the people that are looking and acting racist, a lot of them, like not a lot of them, I shouldn't say, but the ones that I've talked to have all broken that racist facade. Once you see through them and you talk to them, there is this scene basically where someone is just acting really stereotypical Japanese of 8 years ago. And I say stereotypical Japanese 8 years ago, maybe like 20 years ago, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Like just very, very bad. Okay.
Yeah.
And then I talked to them and I was like, my character is basically says, cut the bullshit. Nobody talks like that. Like, this is ridiculous. Like, stop. Like, are you putting on this front?
Yeah.
And I was really shocked because I was half expecting it to be like, okay, is this person like, how are they going to now react to me? And basically that person completely dropped the act. And ever since you talk to them, is just talking like a normal, Japanese American person, which is like a normal human, like anyone that would grow up in America would talk. And that's weird to even have to try to explain that, because this game is trying to comment on things like sexism or racism or like, right, perverseness. And they're trying to comment on it, but they're also trying to tread this line between, that's what this world is, and it's all the adverts, and they've come out and said you're not supposed to want to be in Cyberpunk 2077's world. Like, that's the point of the narrative.
Yeah.
And so it hits that uncanny valley though, because you as the player, and right, we talked about with this Hades, you as the player want to live in Cyberpunk's world. You want the cool gadget and the cool gear, but then you immediately have to become desensitized and dissociated and hate the world, because Johnny Silverhand hates the world. He's that rocker boy that's going to take down the man. But also you try to take down the man. That's your job as like a mercenary or whatever. And also like you want to change the world and make it different, which is really, really compelling. But immediately is at odds with what you, I think, as a player, when you're doing a tabletop role playing, when you're playing Dungeons and Dragons, you want to be that cool bard that takes down the man.
Yeah.
Like, so it immediately creates the schism, because Cyberpunk has risen so much in the past 8 years as a genre, right? For not only games, but in movies with like Blade Runner, right? 2049 coming out, with Paradise Killer is a great game. I'm going to pitch right here. My great friends on Twitter, go play Black Ice on Steam. It is incredible.
It is,
I
actually
played that game when there was no UI. Yeah. That is how old I have been following that game and how old I am. Woo woo. But play Black Ice. It's an amazing cyberpunk game, right? Frostpunk. Let's see. There are so many cyberpunk titles, basically, is all what I'm trying to say. Necrobarista, I would consider that cyberpunk, though it's a little bit like ghostpunk, if that's the genre it is now.
I just made it up.
Specifically for Necrobarista, go play that. It's great. So there's just all of these cyberpunk titles, right? That honestly, 8 years ago in 2012, we did not have, because cyberpunk was not a known genre. So even in 2016, it wasn't a popular genre
at the time.
It wasn't a popular genre.
Because it's not just a game thing.
It's not just a game thing.
And that's part of the issue here. I mean, if you have more to say, I want to let you finish, because I have a lot of thoughts about this. So if you have more to say,
say all your things. I talked a lot, please.
Okay, well, so actually let's talk.
I want to end on Yakuza.
So you brought up a lot there, a whole lot. So I want to begin with at first it doesn't seem racist, then it seems really racist, and then it seems not racist again. Because
semi-not racist.
maybe not racist, not quite anti-racist, but maybe not racist, because this is actually a problem endemic to the cyberpunk genre going all the way back to its inception. Because particularly when you look at the science fiction, sort of the so-called cyberpunk science fiction novels of the late 70s and the 80s, William Gibson is especially guilty of doing this.
Yes.
Japan is the sort of figurative thing in the Western imagination, precisely because Japan, and you guys can't see me, but I have giant scare quotes around this word.
Japan.
Because Japan is not an actual place. Japan is a figurative thing. And what it is figurative of is this world in which there is hyper technological development, but also all of the seedier aspects of society have sort of been carried along with it.
Now, for a quick literary note, just for all of our listeners out there, in the 1980s, the United States was being outclassed by Japanese engineering and technology. And so this really came with this figure of Japan. So Gibson, right, writing in the 80s, cyberpunk also writing in the 80s. This is what fueled, right, this area.
Well, it's more than that. There was also intense anti-Japanese racism in the United States in the 80s. And there was this sort of palpable... It was at a time of deindustrialization in the U.S., which actually had nothing to do with Japan. It had more to do with, crappy capitalists. But there was this fear that somehow this hyper-developed Japanese economic juggernaut was going to completely subsume the United States. And the best literary example of this, and it's actually a fairly good novel, is the Marge Percy novel He, She, It. Where there is in the novel, there is this Japanese multinational, but basically Japanese mega corporation, which has subsumed much of the United States. The novel is a lot more interesting than that fairly racist trope. But the thing is, this was a common thing in especially science fiction literature of the time. But the thing is, this Japan doesn't actually exist. It didn't exist then. It arguably doesn't exist now. Simultaneously, cyberpunk there is actually a Japanese version of cyberpunk as a genre. And the sort of the most emblematic text here is probably Otomo's Akira, or Akira, as people insist.
Akira.
You guys are just going to have to, I teach Japanese literature. If I use Japanese pronunciations, I apologize. I don't always know the proper anglicization. I'm sorry. But in Akira, but the thing is the Japanese version of it is different. And interestingly, the Japanese version of cyberpunk oftentimes does to the West what the West's version of cyberpunk is doing to Japan. So in other words, there's cross-pollinating cultural appropriation. It's super weird. And somebody really ought to write a book about this. In fact, there's kind of a book about this, but I don't think it's very good. So I'm not gonna suggest reading it.
We'll write the book later.
But so there's that. There's that sort of tense history of sort of this representation of not just Japanese-ness, but Asian-ness. And then the weird cross-pollinization that you get in a film like the original Blade Runner, which is super weird because the film itself is not just sort of like presenting to you an idea of Japanese-ness. It is also based upon certain cinematic tropes in Japanese like film history. What makes it doubly weird is then Blade Runner becomes this incredibly important film that influences Japanese science fiction filmmakers and also especially animators. So when you're watching a film like, say, Oshii's Ghost in the Shell, that is a film that is heavily influenced by Blade Runner, and Blade Runner was heavily influenced by these Japanese films. So again, there's this weird cross-pollinization that occurs. And so to me, that's the less racist version. That's actually, you're taking really brilliant, like, artistically minded directors, and they're actually like critically analyzing each other's work and using it in interesting ways. The problem is cyberpunk as a genre also has this incredibly crass use of sort of a presumption of Japanese culture that essentially stands in for like the weird hyper technological kind of sexy other. That's essentially what it means. Because it's not just about like, oh, cool, we can have like weird, you know, augmentations of our bodies. It's also about bodies as sexual objects as well. And so if you look at like a lot of the artwork for the cyberpunk pen and paper game, like you will see these like hypersexualized gynoids. There is a like vampires and werewolves like add-on, where like literally every single character is basically wearing
long hair. Need to go into the Omegaverse, it's fine.
It's hard to tease apart these two things, because I think you're right to point out that like it feels kind of racist, but then also at times it feels kind of not racist, and the reason why is because the genre actually contains both of those things historically.
And I think that what's even weirder is that like we're looking at this right as, so I mean, we are both Americans, us. We both happen to have like studied Japan and like Japanese history. I have a lot of friends that are either immigrants from there, or they are Japanese Americans, or they're Chinese Americans,
yeah,
or they're, you know, Filipinos or whatever, or Filipino American, that just sounds weird, Filipino is fine, right, Mexican Americans, like I've super super multicultural. So this is all about though like the West, right? In the West, namely America, right, and Japan, we have a lot of this cultural inference. But CD Projekt Red is located in Poland.
Yeah.
So as I am playing this game, I am curious that they're looking at a lot of this not through an American lens or through a Japanese lens. They're looking at things through, right, this Polish or European lens. So now I have to go, what is that European lens?
I can explain what that is, actually, especially because of the Polish connection. Particularly when it comes to Japanese science fiction directors, when they, in fact, Oshii is a good example of this. So let's go back to our good pal Mamoru. So when he's not doing his animation thing, Oshii has actually made several live action films, many of them filmed in Poland using Polish actors. A good example of this is the film Avalon, which is a bizarre film. I highly recommend watching it. You'll probably not be able to make any sense of it whatsoever, but it is in many ways sort of Oshii's attempt to synthesize three things. One, film noir, so like, you know, classic like American like poorly lit detective films.
Yes.
Japanese cyberpunk and Western cyberpunk. All of these three things are in this film in one form or another. It's not, it can be really boring at times. So it's a weird film because it's like really great for someone who is like critically minded and scholarly minded and wants to like to think about all of these weird intersections, but it's actually probably not very entertaining. Weird thing about Oshii is he makes really interesting films that are also very boring films. But that's the connection, because you have these Japanese science fiction creators who are actually very intimately connected with film studios and various other like production studios in Poland. Full stop.
So that's really cool. No, I do think of that. So like, I like that a lot, because when I was living in like the UK and when I visited, like I visited Europe, namely like France and Germany and like Italy and those three countries, like I was in Switzerland for a little bit, but more of a hop, skip and jump to see where Lord Byron died. And then like, that was it. And I think that like, for me living in like the UK and like Ireland as two separate countries, like there just wasn't a lot of Asian influences. And if it was, it was super tropey. Like, this is the sushi restaurant. This is the sushi chain. This is the ramen chain, right? And sushi was like, this is where sumo wrestlers eat. They eat a lot of sushi. And this is the ramen chain. And this is where, like, you know, all the, like, I was like, what did they use? I think geishas is what they use. They're like, this is what, anyway. So just, well, also weird,
in the UK,
weird things.
In
the
UK, when you say Asian, usually that means South Asian.
It usually means South Asian, yeah. Right? Yeah. So Asian was like South Asian. And it also wasn't like Oriental was anything Chinese, right? Yeah, and then the Japanese were like this foreign sushi concept, because like if you ate at like, I think it's called Wagamama. is the chain for ramen. It was more like ramen, and ramen is like the Chinese noodle, the pulled noodle. And I think that ramen, just doesn't taste like, it doesn't taste like ramen. I have to tell you that right now. But you get like this giant bowl of it for like 12 pounds. And when I say giant, I don't mean like ramen is already big. I mean, like, imagine that, but times three. Like, because, you know, in culture and in these movies, ramen's like this huge bowl, right? So obviously it's just a huge bowl of noodles that tastes like fish. And that's what you get when you go to the UK. And some seaweed, but like, it just doesn't, it's not good. But it's not bad. It's just not good. And I think that that's what I'm used to like seeing. And so through like that European lens, it's cool to hear about this like oshi going over there, because like in Europe, it's even more scarce than I think it is in, let's say, America at large or in the West at large. Like, it felt more scarce to me.
It depends
now
on
living
the country.
In California. Now living in California, the country of California.
Yeah, well, it is actually.
Now I'm living in California. It is really uncanny to be playing this game, because I realized, so it takes place in Northern California. Northern California starts around, hold on, San Francisco.
I thought it takes
area.
Place on the border of NorCal and SoCal.
It takes place on the border of NorCal and SoCal.
Yeah, okay.
Right? To say geographically, it really actually takes place in LA. Because conceptually.
Oh, okay,
physically.
Sorry. All right, okay.
Geographically. Because, so I don't know what happened to SoCal or NorCal, because geographically they go, hey, if you're going to go on the I-66 and the 101, be careful. There's a lot of traffic.
Oh, okay.
I-66 and 101 is Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
That's in LA. Like, that is not north of LA. That's definitely not the Republic of Northern California.
No.
And so I have to remember that not only is this looking at the world from like a European view of cyberpunk in the West and in the East, we'll just use those terms for now in scare quotes. But it's also looking at California from this distorted view, because Night City is supposed to be on the border of SoCal and NorCal, but it's technically in NorCal.
Yeah.
Because SoCal is part of the municipal United States of whatever.
Yeah.
Right. And so like SoCal, I guess for real, just means the OC, and Northern California is now LA. Because SF does not exist, but then you see things like Mission and El Camino Real. So when I talk about the Uncali Valley, now that I live in Northern California and I live in the Bay Area, like this game just, I'm like, it's very much like, I can see the board game where it was like, if I had known nothing about California, I would totally put SF and LA together. I mean, those are two cities. That makes perfect sense. But like living in California, there's maybe it's a Polish thing. I don't know.
Because,
but it's
in
the
pen and paper game, like San Francisco exists. Los Angeles doesn't exist because it's sort of been bombed out and destroyed, but sort of like the place where Los Angeles is exists. And Night City, in fact, I looked at this when I was going through the rule book. Night City is located roughly south of where Monterey is now.
Yes. No, I know that because I have the world book, and it's basically like, it probably extends all the way out into Fresno. Like that's where the nomads live.
And then
it's basically like Playa del Carmen. And like, I think that geographically it looks like that. It does.
Okay.
So like on the map of the world.
Yeah.
However, the radio announcers are all referencing highways, and your characters are like, I was driving on the I-80 the other day. And I was like, if you were in Monterey, you're not going to drive 3 hours to find the I-80.
No.
Like,
I think that must be a Polish thing then, because the thing is, like, no American would make that mistake. I would even argue that, like, someone from the Midwest would know that the U.S. is huge, and that, like, even in the state that I live in, Iowa, which is not, it's probably a mid-sized state in this country, like, in order to drive across Iowa, it will take you nearly in it. Like, if you drive from one end to the other, that's basically your entire day to do that. And so the thing is, like, in many ways, that this is why I say it might be a Polish thing, or maybe I could be wrong about this, but the thing is, individual European countries, they're not that actually that big, and it does kind of screw with your sense of distance. Because the thing is, like, you know, in Poland, you can get from, say, I don't know, Warsaw to Wrocław or to Katowice in a very short amount of time. And those are all very big major cities. Whereas in California, like, the time it takes to get from, say, like, San Jose to Sacramento is immense.
I like how you use San Jose and Sacramento as a time, because that is actually immense. It's like 4.5-5 hours.
Yeah.
It's probably less now. It's actually only probably two and a half hours.
But it's a pretty huge distance. Like,
it's a huge distance. But I say 2.5 hours because of traffic, right? So it's like probably 4 or 5 hours.
But that would get you across, like, several countries in Europe.
Yes. No, it would. It would. Yeah. And so why is this is important to Cyberpunk? Because I really love the city of Night City. But I am now, as a Californian, getting super, super de-immersed every time that someone starts to bring up a highway that I have to tune it out.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't want to know. I can't. And then if I, like, find El Camino Real, I'm like, that's really cute. But now that I see the direction El Camino Real is going in and, like, where it's geographically located, I'm like, Elko doesn't go that way. Like, that's not right. But, like, at the same time, I get that it's an amalgamation of all these neighborhoods. So, like, Mission is in, like, the poor Spanish neighborhood of Night City. Like, yeah. I get that, because Mission is the poor Spanish neighborhood. This is also in air quotes, by the way.
Yeah.
Of SF.
Because there's no such thing as a poor neighborhood in San Francisco anymore.
No, there's not no such really. Thing as a poor neighborhood. There's also like, there's Spanish and kind of Mexican culture, like, everywhere. And I think that it's just really bad American trope, even of people that have lived in those, like, in that culture, to say, like, yeah, this is our, like, Mexican neighborhood. It's like, no, like, yes, I get that it does exist, but, like, by saying that, you keep them, right, oppressed.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing.
It's just not even.
But again, it's sort of a misunderstanding. I think it's a misunderstanding that, like, an American wouldn't make, because particularly when you're talking about, like, the Latino community is extremely diffuse in the United States. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, there are parts of the country where it's more concentrated, especially, like, you know, in the border states. But, like, even in the Midwest, there are, like, massive, like, Hispanic enclaves all over the place. And they're not really ghettoized. They're not really, like,
sequestered. Yeah, yeah. So I will say that, like, since you haven't played the game, I will say that Night City has, like, different languages pretty much absolutely everywhere.
Okay.
Right? And so, like, you'll hear, like, Chicano, or you'll hear Mexican slang.
Yeah.
Like, pretty much in every, you know, every area. You'll even hear some of it in like, the richer areas, like Japantown, also in scare quotes.
Okay.
But for example, you would never hear Russian, right, outside, like, City Center and, like, where all the villains are located.
Yes, because Russian is villain. Because
yeah, Russian is the villain.
We are
talking about Poland, okay? Like, I know that people are like, because that's another element of not only Western American, right? USSR, 80s, all Poles of that.
Have like, the Polish have a weird relationship to Russia as well, because Poland used to basically be controlled by the Soviet Union.
So. And as they should. But I will say that, like, so other than, and if you hear Russian not in, like, this very high class area, you immediately are like, that's trouble, right?
Okay, yeah.
I will say that also if you hear Japanese, like, you know, it's part of a gang, but the Japanese, like, translation, or, like, you'll actually hear Japanese and then it auto translates with subtitles.
Okay.
The Japanese is actually very good.
Like, yeah, because I mean, because, like I said, there, when it comes to sort of, like, knowledge of Japanese as a language and knowledge of Japanese culture, it's very in Europe, it's very dependent on the country that you're talking about. In the UK and in sort of just, like, the general Anglophone sphere, it's less common. But especially in, like, universities in France, in Poland, and also I know in Italy as well, Japanese is actually really...
Yeah, I was going to...
It's almost as broadly represented as it is in the United States. Of Western countries, the United States probably has the most Japanese language programs of, like, certainly of Anglophone countries. But like in Germany, a Japanese speaker would be extremely rare. Or in Switzerland.
Like, I would say a lot of, like, France. I was amazed, like, the more that I've studied the culture, is that, like, France and Japan have a lot more, I don't want to be, like, in common, but, like, a lot more cultural diffusion, right, than I think a lot of people recognize.
Well, they have a lot more of a historical relationship.
Right. And when I was living in Scotland, it's also actually very true that Scotland and Japan actually had a longstanding, like, trade negotiation as well in that history.
Yeah.
And the only reason why I discovered that is because the creator of Hatsune Miku came and gave, like, a talk. And I was, like, the only student there that recognized that this guy created something that was very culturally relevant. But all of the professors were like, he's a very good, like, tech company because of Yamaha. And I was like, no, it's Hatsune Miku. Like, he's here for, I'm like, can you, I take my picture with you because of Miku? And he was just like, oh my gosh, like, you're the only person here that knows what I actually worked on.
Well, if I remember correctly, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna,
we keep doing this to each other. Thank you. So I was just gonna add that, like, so, you know, the American perception of Japanese-ness is very different, in part because the United States actually has one of the largest, like, ethnic Japanese populations of any country in the world. The largest, I believe, is Brazil. In fact, I think the United States might be the largest. It's either Brazil or the United States. We're very close to each other. So the thing is, like, we in the Western Hemisphere, I'm not saying the West, the Western Hemisphere, have a very different understanding of, like, our relationship to Japanese culture, precisely because of sort of, like, the historical economic relationship between the United States and Japan, and then also sort of this, you know, the very real presence of Japanese people in the United States. So, but the thing is, a lot of countries don't have that, and it's sort of indicative of, like, American chauvinism, that you just sort of assume that, like, oh, well, you know, you European countries are also part of this amorphous thing known as the West. You must have this, like, similar cultural relationship, and they just don't.
No, and I knew that they wouldn't, like, and I didn't really not expect. So, like, I bought the World of Cyberpunk book, and I actually read all about it. So I didn't actually expect this game to be super, super, like, hits nails on the head with California, or super, super hit the nail on the head with, like, this pseudo assumption of Japanese-American relationship that's supposed to exist everywhere. But I read that this Japanese game known as the Tiger Claws, with a Y in tiger, I was like, that would never be in Japanese. Like, TY is not a, anyway, like, that's just not, like, a linguistical thing that you would see. So looking at it, like, in terms of just, like, sheer, like, I guess, true and accurate representation of, like, these cultures, I wasn't expecting that. But, like, playing it, I actually feel like I am getting more dissonance because I live in California, or because I am an American and I understand about, like, American distances of the genre itself, than I do the cultural representation, having not assumed it. But then I think that because a lot of media, especially about games, comes from two sources, right? Those that are American sources, or at least, like, on the internet, I'll say, American sources and American Twitter, right? And second, though, are these the angry gamers about complaining about bugs and rough launch and wanting returns, that we're overlooking the fact of all of the things that this game has done really, really well, which is, like, yes, it's not an accurate portrayal of Japanese, but, like we've said, this is coming from our lens of having a high ethnic representation of the Japanese and of just, say, Asians in general, or anybody from, right, the Eastern Hemisphere. Like, this is going to include Indians and, right, like, that whole area. Like, we understand it very differently in America. And it's not, I don't want to use the word melting pot, because that's, like, so, like, 20th century literature right there.
Yeah, it's also just not very accurate.
We definitely understand our cultural differences, and we have, like, this different appreciation for it than I think other.
Ideally.
Appreciation is also wrong. Ideally.
Yeah.
I don't know. We see it differently, I think, is the
point that's probably the best
that we're trying to make, right? We see it differently. And then I'm playing this game as a Californian, and I see it differently because I live here. Like, I live in this pseudo San Fran, like, Los San Fran, Tokyo, Angeles thing.
Yeah.
Known as Night City. And I am loving Night City, but it's just so bizarre when like the highways and the roads are the same places where you live.
Yeah. But then also not the same place.
And then also not the same place, right?
Yeah. No, I can understand that because, I mean, it's almost sort of convenient living in the Midwest because since we are flyover country, nobody cares to make anything like culturally relevant about the Midwest. It is because it is kind of a boring place to live, but that's sort of what's nice about the
James T. Kirk was born in Riverside, Iowa. Don't forget about that.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, I live
Star Trek.
I actually live very close to Riverside, Iowa. It's basically like a 20-minute drive from where I live. My wife and I have both been
which
there.
Is actually really close because it's only 20 minutes, like just so that we're clear.
Oh yeah, a 20-minute drive is like a hop, skip, and a jump. That's not when I say 20 minutes,
because in some places 20 minutes would be like, wow, that's so far away. Like,
well, like, so my mother-in-law lives just north of Cedar Rapids, and that's like a 45-50 minute drive from where we live, probably about 45-minute drive, which doesn't seem like anything to me. That's like, oh yeah, we do that all the time. Like, that's whatever.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is in the US. No, and I recall like being sort of reminded of how bizarre this actually is. Because so a couple of years ago, some friends of ours, the Kobayashis, they came to visit us, and I picked them up at the Cedar Rapids Airport. And as we were driving back, my friend Yasuko, who was riding shotgun with me, she was just like in awe of like the broad horizon, just like the horizon. And she started like riffing on the nature of the horizon, this thing that I literally see all the time. And I'm just like, Tevs, like, whatever, because it was just like, you couldn't see the end of it. And it was kind of shocking and it was disorienting for her. And she was like, I'm kind of freaking out. And I was like, welcome to America.
like, welcome to America. This is your daily view. It will never end.
Yeah. It's little things like that, I never notice, and that I have to have like, this is actually, I mean, so this is my pitch for like why people should do cultural studies and why you should study abroad and do all of these things, is because it's really important to have those other perspectives, not just so that you can sort of like understand where they're coming from, but you can also see yourself and where you come from differently as well. And not make all of these like bizarre American assumptions that we have. Sorry, that's my pitch for
class. Don't apologize for that. No, take his class and don't apologize for that, because I think that something that we think about is Americans is that we know what's right and we know what's best. Yeah. And sometimes we counter that with, well, we know what's best for ourselves. Okay. Yeah. Right. And that's even a little bit more selfish than the first thing, is that we know best. Because at least you can be ignorant enough to think you know best. But then if you know what's best for yourself, it's like, ooh, now you're personalizing that ignorance specifically to use an individual. And I think that what comes from cultural studies is sometimes you recognize not just you don't actually know what's best, but also that you actually don't know what's best for yourself because you've never been in other situations which have made you question what is best. Right. Yeah. And I say best very pointedly because it's not about like truth or good or bad, right or wrong. It's about what you subjectively think is best, right, for you as an individual or you as a nation. And if you don't do those cultural studies, even if it's a thought exercise or literally going and studying abroad or just living abroad, right, for a couple weeks. Yeah. Like a couple weeks is enough to do it, especially if you don't speak a language in a country, because you'll get there. And the first 2 or 3 days, you can speak your English, you can feel like a tourist. But once you stay there longer and the same people kind of see you, you start to get that I'm the outsider judgment. And then you start to feel, right, you need to start speaking the language.
Yeah.
You start to feel uncomfortable. And if you've been in a foreign country for 7 days straight, either by yourself or even with someone who's there, and you have never felt uncomfortable, like immediately red flag, like right there is like, you're just not, you that is not culturally aware.
Well, you're also essentially saying that you have no sense of self-reflection whatsoever. Like if you live in an alienating environment for even just like a relatively short period of time and you have no feeling of dissociation whatsoever, then yeah, you're just not very self-aware. I mean,
you are not self-aware.
I don't want to be crappy about it, but actually that's an important point to like go back to this question of like how Cyberpunk 2077 as a game works through its own issues of appropriation, because Well, let's actually talk about a second for the fact that, you know, the game is in English. And so the thing, for the most part, like English is the primary.
But the game was originally written in Polish.
Oh, okay. That I
in order to be a writer at CD Projekt Red, your primary language has to be Polish. You have to be a Polish native speaker. And then you speak English as the primary method of like communication and business.
Okay.
But Polish is the primary written. So it was actually written in Polish first. I'm going to go ahead and make that claim. Anyone from CD Projekt Red is perfectly capable of saying that it was not. You should still make your argument for saying that it was originally written in English.
Well, I will
it was definitely translated into English as, say, a second language.
Because the point that I wanted to make about any this doesn't necessarily even just apply to Cyberpunk. It could apply to any game.
Well, Cyberpunk 2077. This could apply to any Cyberpunk game. I think.
No, I'm saying this.
Cyberpunk is a genre.
I'm saying this could apply to any game that whose primary language of distribution is English. The argument that I wanted
that
to
is
make,
true.
The argument that I wanted to make was that like English as a language doesn't actually have a specific culture associated with it. Because the thing is, there are many, many, many Anglophone countries, and they're all very culturally very distinct.
Yep.
I mean, and I'm even the ones that have like a shared history, even when you're talking about, say, like, you know, the United States and the UK, or like the UK and Australia, like they have a very clear shared history. But then if you actually go to those places now, you will discover very quickly that culturally they are very different. And even when you go sort of broader afield, like, you know, English is a first language in India.
Yep.
In fact, it's probably one of the more common languages precisely because the Indian subcontinent has so many regional languages, distinct regional languages, that oftentimes English is the primary mode of like communication between them. And so the thing is, when you release a game in English, you can't necessarily assume that like it has a particular cultural perspective. You can assume that it has the cultural perspective of, say, like the particular place in which it was created, which is why I think it's interesting to think about a Polish studio producing a game that is going to be widely consumed in English. Like, I don't actually have thoughts about that, and I want to think about that, and maybe I'll come at some later date.
I have no thoughts about that. That's what I'm really thinking about if I was going to think of Cyberpunk 2077 critically, is that and I know this because it is public knowledge that CD Projekt Red hires writers that are Polish native speakers, because if you go to their jobs page, it says must be Polish native speaker for most of their writing positions.
Okay.
Or anything that involving narrative, just so that we can be clear that if this is not insider information, I don't have inside context at CD Projekt Red. I enjoy the game of my own volition and critique it. Just as such.
Well, plus it wouldn't even be that big of a
being the AAA game like, developer of the two
Polish
of us, I should say.
Polish company requires you to speak Polish. Wow, astounding.
Like, come on, astounding. But for other positions, you don't necessarily need it, right? And I think that because there's other shared languages. Like if you're an engineer and you both speak C++, you can just code to each other. I guess. I mean, that's not actually what you would do, but
well, you still got
to read someone's
code.
Yeah, you would still comment on the code, and you probably comment in English. But even if you didn't understand English correctly, and you would like defines variable for, you know, thing here, that person would go, I know what defines variable for, right? Thing one is. So I think that, I want to look at it from that angle, because honestly, I'm really enjoying the experience. There are some uncanny valley things. But at the same time, it's just like, it's uncanny because I live in California for me. Like, honestly, that's what I've decided to settle on. It's uncanny because like, I do have a huge, like international studies was one of my majors. Like that's what I've done. And I studied abroad and I've traveled abroad a lot. And I love Japan as like a culture, but it's not a, I love Japan for like all of my memories that I have of Japan, right? Like having been there, not like I love Japan because of Japan. It's like, no, I love Japan because I went there and I want to go back to those places, right? I have this nostalgia for wanting to.
Yeah, you don't want to fall into that trap of thinking of it as in monolithic terms. You want to remember
exactly
in personal.
Like terms. I really love Asakusa. I want to go back. That's it. I love, right? Because I love izakaya food. Who doesn't love fried food?
It is great. So for those who don't know what an izakaya is, it's essentially like a bar slash like pub, It's more like a pub, but it's a pub.
I love pub food.
Than drinking focused. Like technically, yeah. The word izakaya literally means like a drinking establishment, like literally a place where you go and there is booze. That's what the word means. There is booze place. But it is much more food focused. Usually.
Yes, it's usually more food focused or just happens to be that you would go because you're expected to drink more than you go because of the drinks, I think is a great way of saying it, because there are then other there's craft coffee now in Japan, which is another cultural diffusion because they brought it back because they saw what we were doing in SF with like Blue Bottle, but actually Blue Bottle was influenced by Japanese pour over espressos. So the whole pour over coffee trend was actually inspired because Japan would hand pour coffee and espresso into the cup directly.
Yeah.
And so I think a Korean couple, or no, maybe they were Japanese. Anyway, somebody invented third wave coffee in San Francisco and now we have pour over. And then they saw pour over and were like, wow, you can make a bigger cup of coffee instead of a small coffee. And so then they brought that over. So another cultural diffusion there for you happening right now and right now in modern times.
So so let's actually talk about Yakuza, because you've already made the point that Cyberpunk 2077 has this sort of like uncanniness to it. Whereas if I'm going to coin a phrase that doesn't really exist in English, there's almost a kind of canniness, a kind of homeliness to Yakuza, despite the fact that there may be sort of weird idiosyncrasies. So talk about that. Explain that to us.
Yeah. So when I look at the canniness of Yakuza, and canny sounds weird because it is a little bit campy. It's a little bit of a campy Yakuza genre game. It's not Yakuza 0, so I will be saying Yakuza, but it is not Yakuza 0, which I think is the most recent one when people talk about Yakuza.
Yeah.
But the Yakuza series basically follows Kiryu, and Kiryu-san is like this lone wolf kind of Yakuza figure who's the white knight in like the dark world, right? So he's always doing the right thing and he's genuinely like a good guy. But he just happens to be part of the Yakuza family. And in this, or just happens to be a Yakuza game,
you know,
or whatever.
you're walking along one day and you trip and suddenly you're here.
So I think that for me, what's really identifiable is that I am watching a series on Netflix called Midnight Diner. It was filmed in like 2019 and 2012, 13, respectively. So it is actually pretty recent. It is not an 80s/90s show like I thought it was.
But it is based on old manga.
But it is based on something older. So there we go. However, so I am watching a lot of that takes place in Shinjuku.
Yeah.
Yakuza Kiwami also takes place in this very small area of Shinjuku as well.
Yeah.
I don't actually even know if the streets are correct because one of them is called like Theater Way, which just doesn't sound like a Japanese street at all, but could be, but in Japanese, right, it would be said something else.
Yeah, so editorial note, Japanese streets often just don't have names because they use a district system. They don't use necessarily like street numbers.
No, exactly. So if you have like a street, I don't really remember street names either. Like I remember saying, oh, it's, you know, this way, this way, and then somehow I would end up there. To be completely honest, and I was with my Japanese, a fluent Japanese speaker at the time. So yes, that was easier, but I did have to get back to our place in Asakusa without her. And I literally was like, oh, it's this way under the highway, over the hill.
Yeah. Right. That's often Japanese people will often draw maps for each other because it's kind of the only way you can figure out where something is.
Exactly. And so that's how I figured it out. And I only knew that I was crossing the right highway because it was a double highway. So in America, we typically have the double highways and in Tokyo you do as well. It's just a little bit rare if you're in city center, I guess. But all of that aside, that's to say that geographically, right, this feels a lot like when I was walking around in Japan as I walk around it. You go into the stores and it's playing Christmas music. It's currently Christmas here for the recording of this episode.
Yeah.
And so instantly I'm like, wow, I'm listening to music that I would be listening to if I was allowed to go outside, if not for COVID. The interactions with people feel very organic. And while it's completely linear, it's all also said in Japanese with Japanese subtitles. So I'm seeing landmarks that I'm used to seeing in a show that was filmed in recent Japan So in 2012, 2013, when I went to Japan. And now I'm seeing it in this game for whenever this game was released. So it feels familiar that way. It feels like being in downtown Tokyo. I'm seeing this constantly in a TV show that I'm watching. And so I'm like seeing kind of the same reflections, the character interactions as they interact with me, as me, the Yakuza member, right? And this is important. Feel like they're either addressing me with like, I hate you, get out of here. Or like, right, oh, like you're great, like welcome, etc. So it feels super, super canny in that geographical layout of the like of the level and of like the narrative, right, of them. But yeah. Something else what's interesting that if we look back on, maybe I'll write about it again, but we look back on our topic about cameras and how the camera makes you feel like you are a person. Mm-hmm. In Yakuza, I will note that it very much feels like first person or second person perspective, because older games used to do this a lot. Recently they don't, but I call it the you're going out of level bounds message that appears on the screen.
Yeah.
And this, most games, if they want to do something linear and it's part of an open world, they're like, you are leaving the animus. You are leaving the level zone, right? You're going the wrong way. You have 20 seconds to turn around. Which is horrible, right? That's immediately immersion breaking. And now you're like, fine, I'll go play your game. But in Yakuza, something that happens is the character himself goes, I need to go to this, to the bar Serena. I need to do this. I need to go to the bar. And then you'll get a call that says, hey, could you just come by the bar? And the guy's like, yeah, I'm there. I'm on my way. But he's going in his head internally, I need to go to the bar. Then the same thing happens with if you go in an opposite direction of where you need to go. He goes, oh, I don't need to go this way. He'll say, oh, this, the pawn shop isn't this way, right? And it's kind of interesting because even though it's open world and I could go that way, technically to get to the pawn shop, right?
Yeah.
He's like, I'm in a hurry. I need to get there fast. And there's something really interesting about that that makes me feel more like I am that person when he's going, I need to hurry. Well, now suddenly I'm like, I'm reading, I need to hurry, or I'm hearing, I need to hurry in Japanese. Yeah. And then it's, and I know how to say I need to hurry in Japanese, so that helps. But then also then it's like, oh, I do need to hurry, so I want to turn around versus the game is forcing me to turn around. And so there's that little like extra quip in there that a lot of games now, whether they're first person or third person or whatever, have completely gone away from.
Yeah.
From something having the character saying, I need to, or having a the dialogue box come up that's like, I need to turn around, I need to do something. And I think that that also helps, because even when I don't want to go in that direction, I'll go, oh, okay, I want to explore this area.
Yeah.
And to top it all off, when I say like I loved, when I said I love Japan, I really am thinking I love like Tokyo, and I kind of love like Nagoya to an extent, because that's also where I was living. But Nags I don't represent. Like love.
Sorry, I live
in Nagoya, represent. But I really just like that underground mall was really cool. I
the one
love,
in Sakai?
Like, yeah, the one in Sakai.
Yeah.
It was cool. It was my cool. Yeah, Sakai represent. And I really love like Tokyo, and I really love Shibuya, and I also really love Asakusa, because that's where I was also like living when I was in Tokyo. So for me, I'm like, I really love these places that I've been, which, you know, oh, like.
That makes sense.
Ironic. That makes sense. I love these places that I've been. And then I'll go back and go, oh my gosh, this totally changed. How dare they change my mental image of, right? But I mean, and that's what I'm saying I love, is that, so I'm watching this and I was rarely in Shinjuku, but I was in Shibuya a lot, and there are, and I was also in Ikebukuro. So like when I visited those like areas, though, they're actually very distinct looking, but like the game itself, since it's a kind of an amalgam of Shinjuku, it's not really all right. Cause it's a game and it's like, we take place in Shinjuku. It's not a one for one, and it's not like Persona 5, which is very much a one for one of Shibuya, and it varies like clearly. This is Shibuya, or this is Kinchi Joji. Is that district also is like a one for one? This is very much like this is Shinjuku.
Shinjuku.
Because it's like it is, and it like when you see it and you get it, you're like, yes, this is definitely a Shinjuku. But then there are areas where it's like fuzzy because they're making a Yakuza game. So they're like, we're going to represent a little bit more of the stuff. And like, you know, and then for reference, they have like this gang come from Asakusa that like, apparently like these kids just left like an hour ago. And then these guys show up, like this whole gang shows up from Asakusa like 10 minutes later. That would not happen in 10 minutes.
Yeah, no, so, not at all.
Not happen. So like, that's what I'm saying is they kind of fudge like the things because it's still a Japanese developer making a Japanese game that's like, you're going to get that it's in Tokyo.
Well, because for a Japanese developer making a game for a Japanese audience, they only really have to evoke these things. They don't really have to like viscerally show them to you.
No, exactly.
Because the thing is like, you know, Asakusa historically in Japan has this association with like the seedier elements of society. There's actually a really famous Kawabata novel about exactly this. And so the thing is like, you know, if you say a gang from Asakusa, it's like, bam, they know what that means. Like, and so the thing is like these places in Tokyo, like, they're already like pretty clear, even if hackneyed stereotyped associations, they're still clear and they're still immediate. So you don't have to like do all of the legwork to evoke it for a Japanese audience in the way that you might have to for say like a non-Japanese audience.
And I think that's where the immersion and like the ability to just instantly kind of get into Kiryu's shoes. I think his last name is Kazan or something.
I don't know.
But it's very easy to get into those shoes and to get into that role of the character because I'm immediately it's just evoking the things that I'm used to, or that I know from my cultural studies. But also, even if it wasn't, it's kind of invoking the true like the Japanese-ness of that area. And I say that really weirdly because it's evoking like what an American I think would think of when you think of like Shinjuku, because you'd be like, this is Tokyo, it's a city, there are gangs,
yeah,
yay, right? And I punch people, like it's a street brawler, and so you're fighting in the street quite literally. The streets are taken from Shinjuku.
Yeah,
if you have seen, like if you have any sort of kind of connection, right, living in America, like with Japan, like you've seen pictures. It also then does a really good job of evoking it for a Japanese audience. And so even as an American, I could be like, I didn't realize Asakusa was actually considered very seedy. And it's thought it was one of the...
Historically.
Not now, but historically. So I didn't know that historically. I actually thought Asakusa was one of the safest places in Tokyo. I'm like, But like, what's going on?
Well, it would be okay, so here's the analogy.
But for me, I got it because I was like, I've been to Asakusa. That's really safe. Oh, it's weird that there's a gang there, right? Like but it didn't throw me out of it, if that makes sense, right?
It would be like Times Square in the US, where like Times Square in New York, for the longest time, like was actually kind of creepy. But now it isn't. Now it's basically just Disneyland in New York. But that's a recent phenomenon. And so it's a similar thing with Asakusa.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. And I was gonna say that because I think it's because since it was made for a Japanese audience, now that I happen to be culturally aware of, or I have been to the areas that like it's depicting in Japan. I just happen to have been. And maybe if I hadn't have been, it would have been not as, like, maybe it's not as good. But I'm saying I'm aware of it. It knows what it needs to evoke. It doesn't have to overexert itself. Contrasted to Cyberpunk 2077, this game feels like it needs to, it is overexerting itself in every possible way.
Yeah.
Because I think that I'm like, oh, I'm just living in Japan. This is great. It's almost as if, like, everything in Night City is like, don't forget you're in Night City. This terrible area. And there's also so much lore that everything they're talking about is just like lore, news, right? And it's so big and kind of boisterously in your face of, did you know that we're a completely original like story and take on this world, that you miss the really cute things where it's like all of your quest descriptions, honestly, actually even kind of from the beginning, maybe I need to replay the beginning for a fourth time. I replayed the beginning 3 times, just FYI, because of crashes.
Yeah.
But like, it's all written in a different perspective that is not actually your own, which then is highlighted later on in the narrative, which is then returned into yourself. And it's a very deep philosophical game, actually, in certain areas that's fascinating. And I love it. But it's like, we're not talking about that because it's so overly in your face for, did you realize that this world is terrible?
Yeah. Well, and also it represents, so these two games represent in many ways a different approach to functionally the same problem. Because the thing is, so you have the cyberpunk version, which is essentially like to go as big as possible, to do everything, to include everything, to like literally turn Night City into an amalgam of everything in California and everything American, plus all of the multicultural elements, plus all of this, plus this, plus this. Like it just, there's like an accretion. It's almost like because the game took so long to be developed, they just like kept piling stuff in, just kept putting more in. Whereas in a game where, and this is actually true of Yakuza 0 as well, like it takes the same basic kind of story, but it presents it in a much more intimate way. So it puts it in a very precise place. Even if it doesn't necessarily like evoke that place perfectly, it sort of, in many ways, I mean, I don't want to sort of talk in culturally essential terms, but you do see this very commonly in Japanese media, particularly stories that take place in Tokyo. They are often like exclusive to a very specific part of Tokyo. Yes. And I'm not even talking necessarily a specific, you know, like district, like, you know, Ikebukuro or something like that. I'm talking often like a specific block. And so there's this really famous manga and then also TV series, and it was made into a couple of movies called Sanchome no Yuhi. Sanchome simply refers to, like, it could be any, like, it literally just means, like, block three, the third block. But it's, like, the culture of this very, it's an interesting contrast, and it's something that you often see in Japanese media where, like, you have these people living very tiny, interconnected, intimate, and sort of interrelated lives in the context of urban sprawl. And so that's interesting to me. I mean, it gets kind of hackneyed at time.
Yeah, no, like
a way to do it.
No, and I'm sorry to interrupt you there, because that was actually a really great point, is that similarly, when you're playing Cyberpunk 2077, while it lacks in, say, overall, say, Night City, like maybe it doesn't really, it misses the mark when it comes to, is the entire city itself kind of this amalgamous thing, is that the blocks themselves and the cultures within those blocks themselves actually create more of those intimate stories. And it does a really good job of differentiating each, I will say, like each city district, because a lot like Tokyo that has like Ikebukuro versus like Asakusa, they're very different. This has like Watson and like Westbrook and like Northside, right? Those are very, very different. And then it also has the Badlands, which is not to be confused with the Utah Badlands. But it could be, I don't know. There are like Arizona, Utah shaped rocks in that area. But like it has all of those things, and it's very intimate when you start there. But because the game kind of forces you to drive around this super dense city, and yet super, like each district is not as big as I think it would be in real life, that also becomes uncanny, because suddenly you're like, you're all living in one city, but people really only live in one district for real in the city. But you actually travel like all around the city. And so it'd be like having a game set in Tokyo where like you could just drive and like 2 minutes later be like in any district of Tokyo.
Thanks again, everyone, for listening. As always, you can follow us on Twitter. You can follow Lauren at TheLaurenAsh on both Twitter and Instagram. And you can follow me at UAHSENAA, also on Twitter. Or, I mean, ideally, you can follow the podcast itself at footy-pod, once again, on Twitter. This is our last episode of the year. I should also note that if you like what you heard, please rate and review us on iTunes. This, as I said, this is our last episode of the year. We will be back after the holidays are over with more of that game dev and theory content you crave. But until then, please, please stay safe, stay healthy, and do not let the man get you down. Bye.